Do you remember when you first expressed an interest in music as well as the guitar?
My mom got me a guitar after I begged and pleaded with her when I was 8 years old, and that's when I first started taking lessons.
Do you come from a musical family?
Not really, but my mom took piano, and she played the flute and still sings in church choir to this day, but she doesn't really play piano anymore. So I guess probably half of a musical family.
Do you have any other brothers and sisters that are interested in music?
None of them ever had a career in music, although my sister did play flute in high school. And then when she got to college, she realized it was going to take a lot more time to minor in music, so she ended up dropping that.
So what for you are your top five jazz recordings of all time?
Wayne Shorter, Speak No Evil, I think is one of the best of all time. After that, one of my favorite Coltrane records, it's just the title, Coltrane. I think it's the one on Prestige. The first tune is called Out of This World, and I've listened to that at least 200 times. I've never, ever tired of the record. I think it's one of the best representations of that, you know, that group with McCoy and Elvin, Jimmy Garrison. Next comes Kenny Wheeler, New High, and that's G-N-U High. That's Kenny Wheeler is like one of my favorite musicians, and I think the record he did with this record has Keith, Dave Holland, and Jack DeJohnette. It's really an amazing record. It's one of my favorite records, and I think from a writing standpoint and an improvisation standpoint, it's about as good as it gets. Next comes Ornette Coleman, Change of the Century. That's again an amazing record. It really was a change of the century.
yeah.
His concept of everything, you know, just forged a new path for so many different people who still play that music. Then last but not least is Miles Davis Live at the Fillmore. I think that's kind of an overlooked record, you know, because everyone says Bitches Brew is the one to kind of start with, but I think at the zenith of that band, Miles at the Live at the Fillmore, that was kind of like that was after the band had been going for a while and the tunes were starting to really open up.
Yeah, I want to get back to Kenny Wheeler for a second. He's certainly one of my favorites. What is it that you like about his compositions?
Well, I think they're really memorable, and any kind of music, for me, if it's memorable, there's some quality about it that makes it memorable and makes you want to go back and check it out time and time again. And all of his tunes are very melodic, and, you know, it's just really, a lot of it's based on the Lydian scale, and harmonies come out of that, and it's not the kind of jazz that's going to steamroll you with, you know, 5,000 notes per minute. It's just, I don't know. It just really sends me to a different place. It paints like a landscape when you're listening to the music.
Yeah, and of course, when it comes to Miles Davis, there's just so much to like about his music from different periods in his career. Do you have a favorite period in Miles Davis's career?
Yeah, I mean, that's another good question. I think every period that he ever tried he was the best at. You know, he was the best at bebop with Charlie Parker. He was the best at the cool school with Gil Evans. He was the best at his '60s quintet with Wayne and Herbie and Ron. And then he was the best at, you know, fusion jazz because no one else was doing it. So he kind of said, hey, check this out. So for me, I think the last period, which is the one that people don't dig as much anymore, that's the important one for me because all of a sudden the guitar was relevant to what he was doing.
Yeah, and what I liked about Miles was that in those different periods, he was not only the best, but he was redefining as he was moving along.
Absolutely.
You know, which really influenced quite a few musicians down the road after him.
Yes. In fact, everybody that we listen to today either played with Miles or had direct lineage in the jazz tree. Like, let's say Miles is the trunk of the tree. Everyone who plays music now can trace their trace their branch of the tree back to him.
There's no doubt about it. Even when you listen to music from artists like Prince, you can see elements of Miles Davis's influence in his playing.
Absolutely.
You know, even from his like you said, from his set, from the late '60s on, he went through quite a transitional period there, and even the last phase of his life, I found was extremely interesting.
I agree, and I think it's a shame that the jazz Nazi police kind of shut that whole period down. I think it's great music. It's great music to listen to.
Well, I think he was on the verge of redefining something else there when he passed away in 91. I thought he was really getting into something there that was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Who are some of the important influences on your playing?
Well, everybody that I just mentioned, of course. But as far as like who I idolize when I try to play music, I would say Wayne Shorter, Allen Holdsworth, John McLaughlin, Herbie Hancock, Coltrane, Larry Young, Kenny Wheeler, Richie Bayrack, and then, of course, all the modern guitar players like Scofield, Frizzell, Stern, Abercrombie, they've all influenced the way I get sound out of my guitar.
It's funny you mention that, because when I first heard your music, the first person I thought of was Jim Hall. I don't know
great.
Why.
because I checked out a lot of Jim Hall when I was in high school, and I knew it would kind of seep in there somehow. And I think since Jim Hall's not on everyone's radar anymore, he's often overlooked, and people say, well, you sound like Pat Metheny, but that's just because Metheny's on the radar. You know, when Metheny was coming up, everyone said, hey, you sound like Jim Hall. So it's come full circle.
If there is only one person living today that you would love to perform with or even record with, who would that be?
Oh, hands down, I would say Kenny Wheeler. I actually had the chance to play with him and do a record as a sideman. We were both sidemen on this project with a friend of mine from Brussels named Erwin Van. And I went to school with him at the Banff Summer of the Banff School of the Arts in the summer of 1988. And Kenny Wheeler was our teacher there, one of the teachers. And then in 1995, I went to Belgium to record this project, and Kenny Wheeler was the featured guest star, basically. And he was just amazing, and his sensibility on the instrument and his personality is so amazing. I mean, he's so easy to hang with, and he just doesn't have any of the, hey, I'm a star, hands-off kind of attitude. So if there's anyone I'd ever like to record with again, and as far as like role model extraordinaire, he'd be the guy.
What was it like going through the recording process with him?
Oh, it's great. The first thing was, as always, you try to get a sound in the studio as a group and your headphone mix and everything. There was a point where they kept asking Kenny, keep playing a little more so we can get a mix on you. And he was kind of getting a little bit irritated. But then on the playback of the first song, they were asking, well, what would you like us to do to your sound? And he goes, nothing. It sounds great. Leave it alone.
Wow.
It was just so cool,
So there was a lot of flexibility in the studio and a lot of improvising as well, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, we had a good 3 days to make this record, which was, it's unheard of. Most records are made. Jazz records are made in a day at most,
right.
And even then it's probably shaved down to about 6 hours. The first 2 hours are spent setting up and getting the earphone mix, and then the rest you kind of cram in there all together.
I think the most important skill that a musician, I think any musician should have, is the keen sense of listening, and probably more importantly, assimilating what is heard into a musical statement. Do you have any comments on this?
I totally agree, because listening is the most important aspect of jazz. Improvisation doesn't mean that there's a soloist, he's standing up there, he's going to play his thing, and all the sidemen just do their thing. It's totally the opposite. It's not like classical music, where if you have a soloist with an orchestra, the soloist plays what's written, the orchestra plays what's written, and there's not much, you know, the interaction is already built into the music. Jazz is the opposite, where we're listening to the soloist, and as a sideman, you react to him, and it's basically a giant conversation taking place between the musicians who are up on stage.
And even if you're, for example, walking down the street, you're still listening, and maybe you'll get ideas for maybe the sounds that the birds are making or something like that?
Absolutely. Any kind of sound or idea that the soloist is going through, I can react to at any time, or I can choose not to react and try to make a different path for the soloist to go down. You know, it's kind of a give and take situation. It's like a giant game of tug of war. I mean, we both have the rope, and both of us can tug at one time, and or not tug, or tug back and forth. It's a unique experience.
And it's never ending.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody wins.
Yeah. When you go to the studio to record an album, do you have a basic idea of what you want to do, or is most of it left up to the moment?
The only thing I have in mind is the amount of tunes I'd like to record. And usually I kind of determine how long they should be just by listening during playback. Because once you reach the 7-minute mark, you're kind of teetering on the edge of, well, is anyone going to listen to this whole track? Because I've recorded 10-minute tracks with different groups, and everyone's kind of like, wow, that's pretty long. So then usually what happens is you go back and shave it down, and someone takes a few less choruses on a improvisation, or the arrangement changes, and all of a sudden it becomes, you know, instant arrangement on the spot. So the only thing I really have together when I go to record a record is the tunes and what type of improvisation that I'd like to hear. Like, okay, this tune is free, this tune has chord changes, this tune is, you know, more fusion sounding. So I already have kind of a concept of what the music is going to be like, but after that it's all left up to what the sideman plays.
Does it take you a long time to compose a piece of music?
I've had tunes that just happen in a half an hour, and then I've had tunes that take, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Sometimes you put them in this little book and you take them out every so often to see if you can figure out anything else. Sometimes it's a jigsaw puzzle that goes together right away, or it's one of those 1,000-piece puzzles that my mom usually buys, but no one ever finishes.
Yeah. What do you like most about composing?
I think it's cool because it's you're leaving your stamp on music, and hopefully the goal would be somebody else will play this someday. So I don't have the mindset that I'm going to write music that only I can play, that, you know, no one else will ever try to attempt to do. I don't ever have that kind of total egotistical view of music. And everyone I listen to, you know, I think they had the same intent, especially Kenny Wheeler. I always like to play his music. Wayne Shorter, I totally enjoy playing his music. So my thought is I'm just trying to extend what I've learned. And hopefully somebody else, when they play my music, will have the same feeling.
It's funny, when you were answering that question, I was thinking of Benny Golson and some of the compositions that he wrote that are still being played today.
Absolutely. I mean, Along Came Betty and all those tunes, they're always called every gig that you go to. I mean, at least the people that I associate with, because they're fun to play and they're great teaching tools as well, and there's always something new you can figure out, you know. Like, no matter how many times you play through a tune like Stella, there's always something new to find each time, or all the things you are. They're just great music you want to keep working on.
And it's a lot of fun playing through the changes as well.
Absolutely. That's for a standard, for me to want to keep playing it, it has to have a harmonic movement and structure that, you know, keeps my interest. So especially a tune like All the Things You Are or Along Came Betty, they just, you know, they, every time you get done playing a solo, you're like, man, I wish I could have done that better. So I have something to work on next time.
So when it comes to composing, who have been some of your influences?
Well, obviously Kenny Wheeler, Alan Holdsworth, John McLaughlin, Richie Bayrack. I think he's an unsung hero in jazz.
Oh, I have to agree, yeah.
Because his harmony, just like, it's like a new map, you know, and very few people want to open up that map and find out what he's doing. And for me, it's perfect because it's a, you know, like the giant polychords that he's writing on the music just kind of have so many different possibilities, different ways to explore chords, scale, modes, everything.
Do you ever have a chance to teach or mentor other musicians?
Yes. Usually in the summer, I end up doing quite a few jazz camps. This year, I'll be teaching up in Maine, again at the Maine Jazz Camp. This will be my 11th year. And I've been teaching at the NYU Summer Guitar Program. And this year, it'll be my 4th year. Last year, for the first time, I taught at the National Guitar Workshop in Connecticut for a week. So that was the first time I've done that. So who knows, I might be back. They kind of tend to rotate different players into the melting pot every year so that the students don't see the same faces and get bored. And then as far as like teaching around school here in New York, I'm on the adjunct faculty list for private lessons at City College in New York and New School. But this semester, no one's called me, so. Not yet, at least. I guess the school's going to start in a few weeks.
So with your busy schedule, do you ever find time to practice?
Well, once the kids come out, that's it changes dramatically. You don't just have hours and hours a day to devote to refining everything you know. I mean, obviously, I don't practice as much as I did when I was in college because, you know, life gets in the way after you get out of school and figure out you have to make money somehow. So, I mean, I still try to get in an hour and a half every day if I can. For me, it's more important to practice every day than it is to practice many hours one day and then have, you know, not so much time the next day and then maybe no time the next day. I think it's more important to practice every day the same time during the day if you can. And, really focus on what you're doing.
So now that we're into 2008, first of all, I can't believe we're already in 2008. Mm-hmm. What projects do you have on the go?
Well, I'm in a friend of mine's band. His name is Chris Terry. He's a bass player from Canada, and we're gonna be doing some touring this year with him. And I just finished doing a New Year's Eve gig with Patty Austin at the Kennedy Center. And that was a really exciting experience. And I also got to go to Japan. It's in September with her as a quartet, so it was really fun. And I'd never been there before. And I play with a piano player in New York named Jay Bianchi, and I think we're going to do a recording in the next few months. And I also work with a singer named Allison Wedding, who used to live in Australia for 6 years, and she just moved to New York. So I think she's going to become an important jazz vocalist in New York here, because the jazz vocal thing is so strong nowadays. When I first moved to town, it was not that way, but all of a sudden the jazz vocal scene is huge here. So, and then of course I have my own trio and quartet that I try to write music for and still try to get gigs.
Do you find that you're getting a lot of work outside of North America?
Not as much lately. I mean, in the early like early part of 2001, 2002, 2003, I was going to Europe at least twice a year, and that band that I worked with, you know, sort of not happening anymore, and it's getting harder for groups to go to Europe because the dollar is so weak against the euro. It's very hard to travel over there. So, I mean, this fall I did a tour with Joel Harrison in the Midwest. It was just nice not to have to get on a plane for 9 hours to go play. But instead we got to sit in the car for 9 hours and drive back and forth between gigs.
Enjoy the scenery.
Yeah.
What are you listening to these days?
I just bought the new Foo Fighters. I know that's not a jazz record, but I really dig Dave Grohl and his band, you know, left over from the Nirvana days. So as far as rock, I'm really into that group. And my mom gave me the new Herbie Hancock CD, which is featuring music of Joni Mitchell. I really like that record, even though it's not, you know, your crash and burn Herbie. It's more subdued, and Wayne Shorter plays on that, and I think he plays great. 2 years ago, my friend John O'Gallagher got me interested in listening to Ligeti, the classical composer, so I'm listening to his solo piano works, and it's just killing me. And then last but not least, I'm listening to João Gilberto, the Brazilian guitar player and singer. And I think it's mind-opening to check out some of his music because the way he phrases and vocalizes Portuguese is killing. It's like a study in jazz phrasing. It's really amazing.
You mentioned Joni Mitchell. It's amazing how many musicians, even jazz musicians, perform her music.
Yeah, there's really something interesting about it, and it's not because it's entirely metric, or I mean symmetric in the way she approaches you know, like the stanzas of a poem. They don't always line up. Each phrase doesn't always add up to 4 bars or 8 bars or 16 bars. It's like wherever her phrase ends, that's where she ends it, and it's cool because it, you know, it gets out of the traditional 32-bar jazz form, which a lot of us grew up listening to and, you know, end up settling on. So I think it's cool. She's kind of pushing the envelope.
And you mentioned before about the Foo Fighters. Yeah, they're one of my favorite bands, and Nirvana was one of my favorite bands as well. Their compositions, I know it's not jazz, but, you know, the walls have broken down over the past few years, and I find that more jazz musicians are just listening to all kinds of stuff these days.
Yes. I mean, I still listen to, you know, Miles, Wayne, Herbie, all the cats, you know, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald. Of course, you know, that's kind of what I do, but I think it's also important to keep an ear out for what's happening in pop music and rap and everything, because any kind of thing that you hear that perks your ear up, you know, it's probably worth listening to and figuring out if you can make it fit into your own music somehow. My friend Dan Weiss, I asked, you know, well, who do you listen to for sitar? And he said, Nikhil Banerjee. And I said, man, I'm going to check him out today. So I went to iTunes, and he's another musician I've been listening to. I bought 4 of his CDs and downloaded the music, and I think it's killing me. It's just really amazing.
What I find interesting is that you can take a segment of a piece of music from any genre and sort of make it your own within the jazz idiom.
Yes, absolutely. Like before when we were talking about Miles, I mean, he took the Cyndi Lauper tune Time After Time.
Beautiful.
And he played it for many years, you know. I mean, it just goes to show, like, you don't always have to play something by Gershwin or Rodgers and Hammerstein to, you know, get over with a large group of people. And Herbie Hancock, same thing. And it's kind of funny because one of his tunes made a crossover into the hip-hop scene, you know, Cantaloupe Island and that type period of music. For a while in the 90s, I mean, you could hear that piano in the background of a lot of hip-hop tunes.
Oh, it was all over. Yeah. I remember hearing a lot of sampling with Herbie Hancock stuff.
Right.
Do you remember your first professional performance as a guitarist?
Yes. I was 16, and I had a New Year's gig at the country club across the street from me where I grew up, which my grandfather and my father built before I was born. And they were still good friends with the owners there. And at the time, I was just getting going gigging, and I don't know who turned me on to going down there, but I think I went down there and left a cassette tape, and sure enough, the guy called me and said, "Do you want to play a New Year's Eve gig?" So my friend Kevin Klinkhammer, who was electric bass player, and I, we ended up playing duo for about 4 hours, ringing in the New Year, and that was my first gig that I ever got paid for.
That must have been a lot of fun.
It was fun. I remember practicing like 8 hours before I went to the gig, and then after the gig, I was thinking, I don't think I can play 8 hours and then go to a gig anymore.
Aside from playing guitar, do you play any other instrument?
Well, I play electric bass, but it's so close to the guitar, it's kind of not really fair. I mean, it's not like playing piano or a wind instrument or drums. And the only other thing besides guitar that I play is banjo, but again, it's all part of the same family. But, and since the banjo is so dissed in the musical community, I almost don't want to mention it.
Oh, actually, what is the best advice you can give to an up-and-coming musician?
Well, of course, practicing, but then after that comes listening, like you mentioned before. It's probably just as important as practicing, and in addition to listening to CDs and MP3s and iTunes and whatnot, it's just as important to go to a gig and support your local musicians and hear what they're all about, and, you know, go to orchestras and any kind of gig to hear live music, because it's such a great experience. Then after listening comes gigging or playing a session with other musicians. And then we go in full circle and we come back to practice. So you have to do all three things and then practice some more.
Yeah. How would you define jazz?
I define jazz as art at an extremely high level of human experience. And it's just like any other art form, except for me, it's kind of like it's you're experiencing art on a higher level than if you're just looking at a painting, because the painting is one dimension. But if you go to hear music, you're actually seeing the musicians play, and you're hearing the music, and it can affect you differently than just looking at a piece of art. I think you have more of a human connection.
Yeah, because it's in the moment.
Right, exactly. And if it's not recorded, that's the only time you're going to have a chance to hear it played exactly that way. And that's what's so unique about jazz, is it's different every time. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not as good. So, and again, that's speaking more towards the human experience of the art.
What was the most memorable concert that you ever attended?
There's two that really stick out in my mind. The first would be, I went to see Remember Shakti, which is John McLaughlin's group where he's playing electric guitar once again with all Indian musicians. And they were playing at Town Hall in New York City. I think it was in 2004. And they played for 2.5 hours in the Lotus position. And it just killed everybody. I think everybody who was there would just couldn't believe what was happening on stage. It was so enthralling, and everybody took solos that just were mind-boggling. And then the second concert that really killed me was, I went to see Kenny Garrett play at the old Sweet Basil in New York in the mid-90s, and it's the only chance I ever had to hear Kenny Kirkland play live. And in the band then was Jeff Watts, and I think it was Robert Hurst on bass. And Jeff Watts just killed the drums. I think the drums were flying across the stage at one point, And Kenny Kirkland destroyed the piano, and the piano started smoking. It was so amazing.
Wow.
It was literally like, I thought there was going to either be an earthquake and the drums would fall through the stage, or the piano strings would break. I mean, it was just one of those concerts where you're just like, I can't believe this is jazz, because I feel like I'm at a rock concert. There was so much energy with that first Kenny Garrett band. And, I mean, he even wrote about it after Kenny passed away. You know, like, I think one of his things he wrote was, you know, we traveled the world together, and I'll always remember that, or something like that. So, I don't know. It was one of the great, great quartets, I think, that I've ever heard play live.
I remember years ago, this was back in the 70s, I saw Shakti perform.
Oh, the original Shakti, yeah.
Yeah, and the funny thing was that after seeing them, I headed over to the Windsor Hotel in Montreal to see Eddie and the Hot Rods, which was it was a fun evening. It was great.
Yeah, entirely different.
Entirely different. Boy, what a lot of fun that was. You were educated at North Texas University as well as the Banff School of the Arts. What was the most important thing that you learned from each school?
Well, in addition to the information that a teacher would lay on you, the best part of those two schools were the other musicians who were there at the time, some of which I still play with to this day, and I'm part of their groups at various times. So it's the whole experience of being in an environment where at the end of the, you know, like midway through the day, when you go in to play with sessions with your other peers, you're instantly exchanging information about what you heard during the day. And then when you get up to improvise, it's kind of like, wow, this is my chance to try out all those things that I heard in the morning lectures and classrooms. So that was so great about going to Banff. I mean, in the morning we have these classes, but in the afternoon we just get together and play, and the sessions would go on till, you know, after dinner time, and then at night we'd have concerts by Dave Holland's group. It was just so amazing. At North Texas, same sort of thing. You'd get done halfway through school, and after the lab band, you'd go right to small group rehearsal and just play for hours and hours. So I think the most important thing about any music school is the other musicians who are there. It's like a sounding board for ideas and techniques and exploration of music.
North Texas has an excellent music faculty, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still friends with all of those guys, and I don't have any grudges against any of them. I love them all to death. They're really great musicians, and a lot of them used to live up here in New York, so going to school there, I think, for me, was a good idea, especially Jack Peterson, who doesn't teach there anymore. He was the guitar teacher at North Texas, but he was one of the founding fathers of the Berklee program. So when I was going to school, the teacher that I had at the time said, well, why don't you go directly to the source and, you know, and check out this cat. So I went down and met Jack, and I don't regret it at all. I think it was probably the best thing to ever do for education.
And the lab band has made some recordings as well.
Yeah, every year the 1 o'clock band goes to the studio and makes a record in the spring semester. And I'm on three different records, 87, 88, and 89. I'm really dating myself now, but
time flies.
It was fun. It was kind of, you know, got your studio experience a little bit before you headed out from school.
Now let's talk about the members of your group. How did the group come about, and how did you get to meet them?
Well, the group on my last record, I met all those guys teaching up at the Maine Jazz Camp, and John O'Gallagher, I think, is unsung hero in New York here for alto saxophone, and he really has some amazing concepts and ideas in his own music. So I knew right away I wanted to record with him, and hopefully he'll be up for playing on my next record. And Mark Ferber, same sort of thing. He's a great drummer. He's currently out touring with Jonathan Kreisberg and a bunch of other, Ralph Alessi, all these people, New York guys. and he's from California, actually. And lately I've been using Matt Closey, bass player from Australia. He's been playing in my trio, and he lives in New York now. I'm really impressed with what he's doing, too.
How many recordings do you have out at the moment?
I have three out as a leader, and then I'm on this Palmetto record that we all kind of co-led. So that's my co-led CD. But I have three as a leader.
So being a first call sideman must keep you pretty busy. I would imagine that you're never out of work.
Well, I end up doing a lot of things that don't have much to do with jazz, and it does keep me pretty busy. So I always have a gig to look forward to, and you know, as far as doing a jazz gig every night of the week, it's for me, it's not going to happen. You know, I play guitar, so I already have one strike against me, and so many groups don't even use a harmonic instrument in New York because there's such a big market for kind of the Ornette Coleman quartet sounding music. So that now I have two strikes against me. Third strike would be traditional jazz guys kind of favor the piano in a trio setting or piano in a quintet sort of thing. So now I have three, you know, that's my third strike. So it dwindles down. So I end up doing a lot of, you know, gigs that some other hardcore jazz guitar players would shy away from. But as a result of doing those other gigs, I don't feel as much pressure to teach, you know, 5 days a week for hours and hours at a time because, you know, I'd much rather be holding my instrument and making a few dollars that way than teaching. But as I said before, I end up teaching in the summertime quite a bit to make up for it.
So what kind of gigs would those be?
Oh, anything. I mean, I do recordings for pop singers. I do bar mitzvahs and I do boat cruises around Lower Manhattan and weddings and private parties and corporate events. I mean, you know, God knows one of my phone calls what it's going to be like, you know. But I work with a couple of different agencies who, you know, regard me as somebody who's going to show up on time and do a good job and not drink too much on stage. So I'm lucky.
So when you're sent to a particular assignment, do you have specific guitars that you use? Like, how many guitars do you have?
The main guitar I use for jazz is a Gibson 335. And then for other gigs that, you know, jazz is kind of low end of the totem pole as for what's expected, I end up using a Paul Reed Smith bolt-on 24 fret model guitar, which was made famous by Carlos Santana. That's not the reason why I bought it, but I just liked the sound of it when I played it at the store, and I've had it for nearly 16 years now. That's probably my go-to guitar for everything else. And then I also have a Fender Mexican synthesizer Strat, which I don't use that much. And then I have I just bought a Jay Terser Tele, which I think is cool because it's so light, but I don't really have it set up yet to play gigs with. So I guess four electrics, that's about it.
And growing?
Well, I don't know. I'm so happy with the first two that the other guitars that I play just don't really knock me out much. I think the best example of a person who only uses one guitar is Ben Maunder. Ever since I've known the guy, he's only had this one Ibanez 335, and that's what he plays on every record and probably will play till he dies. He just doesn't have a desire to, like, go out and buy a billion guitars and set them all up with different strings. It's really funny. He's my hero as far as less is more.
Didn't Dizzy Gillespie only have that one trumpet?
I'm just probably thinking, one that he bent from rehearsal.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that's what happened. Like, somebody sat on it or something, and then he picked it up and was like, "Hey, this is it."
Nice sound, yeah.
Thanks a lot.
What is it that you enjoy most about the process of recording?
The very rare chance of, like, playing an incredible solo. You know, like, there's a few times on recording where I got done and thought, man, that was great. You know, like, most musicians, and I'm no different than anybody else, are very self-critical. So the minute you hear something that's not exactly what you thought you should have played, it becomes like a self-deprecation issue, you know. So every once in a while when you do something in the studio and you're just like, wow, that's cool, you know, let's go again, let's keep going, you know, that's the moment when you're most happy about it. You know, probably 75% of the time for me is, you know, geez, I wish I had a better sound, I wish I played a better solo, why is that chord voicing sounding so crappy on the playback? Like, it's such a analytical process. You know, it can take the fun out of playing music. That's why when you hear some of these live recordings, they don't sound so great, but the ideas are just less processed, if you could imagine it that way.
Well, Pete, it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Well, thanks so much for calling me and asking me to do this, Randy. It's great to talk to you, too.